Hello and welcome to Prospect Barbacast, the only prospect podcast in the world.
On this stream?
On this podcast feed. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. We're joined by Mike Farron here at the winter meetings in Nashville, the only 10 I see. And we're going to do, amongst the Ohtani drama and all the managers discussing nothing, we're going to focus on prospects instead, because that's what we do on Wednesdays here on the Barbacast. Mike Farron sitting next to me.
Good to see buddy. You. It's nice to see you guys in person. Can we also mention that there actually is no Ohtani drama because literally nothing is happening?
There is Ohtani drama, not with him. There is Dave Roberts drama, but we already talked about that.
That's different. But, nobody else in the Dodgers organization will admit that they actually had a conversation with him.
He doesn't exist.
Who?
He doesn't exist.
This is going a long way by his agent to avoid having to go to the Opryland. I'll let you. This is so galaxy true. Brain thinking on
are
the part
sure,
of Nez Bilolo.
Are we sure Nez isn't here and just lost? All right, anyway. We are not talking about Ohtani on this episode. This episode of Prospect Barbacast is going to focus on the stunning results of the second ever draft lottery. Last year, we had a draft lottery, and the Pittsburgh Pirates won the first draft lottery ever. The draft lottery instituted into Major League Baseball. We see it in the NBA. We now have it in Major League Baseball as, I guess, in the most basic form, a way to discourage tanking. That is the most basic way to phrase it. Whether that works or not, before we get to the results of this one, what do you like when this was introduced? How did you feel about it, and how do you feel about it now, regardless of the results of the first two?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting developments in it, right? So, you know, J.J. Cooper wrote about this because J.J. Cooper, who is like Mr. Draft of Baseball America, got to be in the room for the ping pong balls being bounced. And it's similar to the NBA, right? There's like a code, basically. You get these four numbers, and if they match, you know, what the team has, then they get it. And the first time they ran through it, the Nationals won the lottery.
Yeah.
But the Nationals can't pick in the top 10 because they pay into baseball's revenue sharing. So the earliest they can pick is 10, and the reason they didn't just, according to JJ, they didn't just pull the Nationals' numbers is that would have changed the odds for everybody.
And they did a horrible job of communicating that beforehand, yes, because on MLB.com, they showed odds for the first pick that were different than last year's odds. And it was because of the Nationals. Yeah. Last year, the three top odds were around 16.5%. This year, when they published it yesterday,
18.6,
it was 18.6,
right?
Yeah. And it was because the Nationals were not in it.
That is some minutia.
I made it through college without buying a calculator. And so, like, the odds is, it hurts my brain. Like, this is too much math for me.
It's fine.
Sorry, I can't.
Well, you picked the right sport to cover then, Jake, if you can't handle math.
It's money. Well,
there are definitely, as you mentioned, it is definitely some minutia, but they're clearly still ironing out the process for this because of the rules involving the penalties, what teams can be in the lottery X number of years in a row for all these different reasons that we don't necessarily have to get into. But the basic premise, do you generally support?
Yeah, I think I do. And I think the idea of taking those teams that are higher revenue teams and not guaranteeing them a spot in the lottery year after year. I mean, I can understand the driver behind that from the Players Association standpoint that wants the focus to be on major league players, right?
Yeah.
So like this year, the White Sox finished fifth in the draft lottery. Next year, they won't pick earlier than 10th.
Right.
Right. So, like, if they have one of the 10 worst records, or they end up, if the White Sox don't make the playoffs next year, right? So,
man, the Orioles really got this thing in under the radar didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that really is the reason why this existed from a more recent perspective. Like, the O's drafted first twice and second once and got Holiday, Kerstad, Henderson, and, Holiday.
Yeah. Kowser.
Like, they
Rutschman,
got,
right?
They got so many good players with all that pool space.
And that's the thing, is it's not just about, you know, when we talk about the draft lottery in an NBA context, it's, oh my God, they won, they get to pick this generational player. So that's sort of true in baseball sometimes, but really it's about all that money that you get with that number one pick and all that pool space, which is something that, as we talk about the draft of this podcast in the future, we will cover more in depth.
Now, Guardians fans, we have good news and bad news. What do you want first?
Give the bad news first.
The bad news is this is a historically bad draft.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it's probably a little early to say that it's really tracking that way.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
It's a bad draft.
We'll get into the draft in a minute. It is not going to be as bad a draft, in my opinion, as 16 and 17 were. It's not going to be that bad.
Yeah. I was 7 years old when those happened, so I don't remember that.
So historically, let's not do so full of it. And we're way too early to be declaring any sort of historical comparisons, but. Maybe it is not necessarily quite the draft we just had. We ended up with five super duper top talents at the very top,
right?
And we knew that pretty early on. That was that. As we sit here now, that is not seem the case. We're going to get into some of those players in general.
Just but quickly, when I say it's a bad draft, I'm overreacting. It's a worse draft than it was last year, which was a historically good draft. Right now, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong. The top five picks from last year would be the consensus number one guy right now.
Yeah, any one of them would. And I think the top pick in 25, who is, you know, Ethan Holiday, who's Matt Holiday's other, you know, Jackson Holiday's younger brother, and son of Matt Holiday, would be the number one pick in this draft, too. So, but it's not a particularly strong draft. It doesn't look like behind Ethan Holiday either. The reason is, and we can get into this more, is that there's just not, like, there's not middle of the field, like, shortstop, center field college players, and really not surefire shortstop center fielders at the high school level. And that's what tends to drive draft, because if you're athletic enough to play those positions, if the bat comes along, even if you can't handle it defensively, you have to move off the position. Most of those players who are near the top of this draft have already moved over. They're at second base or they're first baseman. And, you know, like 2017, we saw a lot of first baseman taken early. That's part of the issue with that draft class. So I think that's what why we talk about it this way, although it is way deeper in college pitching than it has been in a while.
Yes, and we're going to get into, again, and part of it is, right, high school in general classes is a lot shallower. So we'll get to some names in a second, but, I mean, let's just read for those who didn't see, you know, again, the way a lottery works, right, you have the worst records have the best chances to get in the top, but we had two teams jump up in shocking fashion. The Guardians, who had the ninth best odds to get the first pick, end up getting it. They had a 2% chance to get the number one pick. They get it. The Reds had a less than 1% chance. They had the 13th best odds. They jumped from 13 all the way to 2. Then we have kind of a, you know, a run of the bad teams that you would more expect to be at the top of draft. Rockies 3, A's 4, White Sox 5, Royals 6, Cardinals 7. That was one I was very interested in because the Cardinals certainly not. I mean, I know the lottery's new, but the Cardinals are very much not used to picking in the top. And the last time the Cardinals picked in the top 10 is who knows.
That's a good question.
I'm sure that's been mentioned before, but Cardinals picking 7 is a pretty significant thing. Angels 8, we've certainly seen them there before. Pirates 9, Nationals 10. They're, you know, the interesting situation where their pick was moved down. But let's get into, again, this top 10, especially for Guardians, Reds fans.
Clap
White
it up
Sox,
for Ohio. Clap
Ohio,
it up for Ohio.
I mean, I always clap it up for Ohio. I'm a big OHIO guy. And, I mean, just hilarious. Guardians, Reds 1-2.
Last time they were in the top 10, 1998, they took J.D. Drew.
There you go.
He was pretty good.
That's we were three.
That is just okay. So anyway, so this is
go
huge
to hell,
deal.
Jake.
Huge
go
deal
to heaven,
for the Cardinals.
Mike.
That's the year I graduated college.
Huge deal. Yeah, and you're
wait,
old,
wait,
Mike.
Wait, Mike, you're older than us. Okay, all right. So the
cut fair and open.
Hard. You can only be young
open.
Once.
Count the rings.
The Cardinals are picking 7. So again, long way to go. You know, fall ball is behind us, so we've learned some stuff. People who, you know, Mike and I, who spent a lot of time talking to people about the draft and how the draft
Jake sent this one out.
No, but this is important. This is a good excuse for Jake to, you know, get kind of introduced to this class. And so we're going to keep it pretty simple here, you know, on this episode. Basically just talking about what are the, if there are strengths, you know, at the top of this class, and who are some names that we could expect to maybe be in the mix for some of these top picks. Do we need to do something before that?
Yeah, I just want to talk about Cleveland getting the first pick a little bit.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah.
It's like, never happened before.
It's crazy.
They've never had the first pick?
They have four times they had the worst record in the American League.
Oh,
but they were in
like
years where they alternated between odd number of years was the National League teams. Yeah, we got the first pick. They got the top pick, and the AL teams did the others. So they've picked second a bunch of times, but they've never picked first before.
Yeah, which is wild.
They go back to 1965, so it's almost 60 years now.
Leave it to a time like this where they had such a small percent chance to get the first pick, and you know when like a Premier League striker scores and the announcer's like, oh my god, you can see, look at what it means to him, Antonetti the president of baseball operations for the Guardians.
Saw a clip of him going wild.
The clip of him like running to whoever the rep was and like hugging them. It was like he scored a Champions League winner. Okay, ten on tenetti.
But I mean, this is and here's the thing. I mean, it's not just okay. We weren't that bad, and now we have the first pick. I mean, it's hard to deny. It's like a team like Cleveland, you're looking to infuse as much talent as possible. And if unfortunately, I don't want Cleveland to be as cheap as they are. But, like, that's a team that is going to reap extreme benefits from picking this high in the draft.
Well, they're going to reap extreme benefits from having the pool money. And I think, you remember, it's not just them that buck the odds. It's Cincinnati, too.
Cincinnati, too.
So, like, the fact that those are 1-2 is pretty crazy. And I haven't followed the NBA draft lottery closely enough over the last 20 years to really have a good feel for how often that's happened, you know, more recently. But, it's crazy to think that those two teams, you know, who really bucked the odds and they're 1-2 in this. So, it's great. And I'm sure during the course of the spring and summer, we'll talk more about how the draft pool works. And for those who don't know, but really it's given the Guardians about $4 million more in draft capital than they would have had if they'd picked in the regular spot.
Wow. That's
a massive deal. And that's also, by the way, a huge deal for the Mets, who also, because that's a different situation, but because they're so far over, you know, the salary cap, or the luxury tax, I should say, they get punished. Their pick drops down if it doesn't end up in the top six, which it didn't.
Right, and the same with the Yankees and the same with
the Padres. But they were not really in the discussion because they didn't have a good chance at getting in the top six, whereas the Mets did. So they're picking 19th, I believe, which is, again, when you talk about it's millions of dollars in pool space, which is a big deal when you're kind of putting a draft together. So let's kind of get into some names. Again, we don't have to go too deep here, but as you see it now, Mike, again, we talked about that five that we kind of had at the top of last year's draft, and you could argue the order and so on. But, you know, the order is certainly not crystallized, in my opinion. But do you see a tier at the top, even if it's not necessarily that great? But, like, do you see a clear tier at the top right now?
Okay. No, I don't think there is one. I mean, I think there are players that you like. You know, I was sitting with some folks from an amateur department today, and we were talking a little bit, and I was like, who would you take 1-1 right now? And the consensus at the table was J.J. Weatherholt, he's going to play shortstop for West Virginia. He's really viewed as a second baseman. He had a season last year that was good enough to win the Golden Spikes Award, which is the top amateur player in the country. He's got some power. He doesn't strike out. He can really run. And so, like, as of right now, Weatherholt, it might be the guy, but it's not, like, the problem is that, like, it's him or Travis Pizzana, who's a second baseman, who's at Oregon State, who hits the ball really, really hard. He's an Aussie, which has producer Chris, like, going nuts.
Can we just get this on the record? Chris, I want you to say Travis Pizzana's name as Australian as you can.
And then every time we mention his name from now until he gets, you know, picked in the top five, you need to edit in you saying it. I'm joking, but it would be funny if you did that.
Do you know that you guys only ever get me to say things in because you want to hear me, like,
but at least you should put on an American accent say the Australian
but
name.
The only time they get me on is like, say this in your accent.
Yeah, Brady
was talking about when Jake is going to be in Australia later this month, and we're going to try to do a bit where we get him to say things in his weird American accent while he's in Australia.
That's absolutely how you should handle that. Yeah. I agree. Anyway, Travis Pizzana. Okay, now
he didn't say it.
Oh.
Travis Pizzana.
Authentic.
Here's the thing. So you mentioned Weatherholt and you mentioned Pizzana.
Yeah.
You just mentioned something there quickly that's important, and if you're just from learning about him now, it's not that big of a deal. Weatherholt played second base last year.
Yes.
And I think we've seen him at third as well. Pizzana, I don't know if it doesn't seem like we're expecting he's going to play second base.
He's just a second baseman. But he can really hit.
No, I know. But the point is that there's an opportunity for Weatherholt to prove he can play shortstop. And if he puts up the same kind of statistical absurd year, now he moves into a tier where it's like teams are talking about him in a much more excited sense. But when we're starting with second baseman and we're going to get to Nick Kurtz, a first baseman at Wake Forest, you can already start to say, like, normally, as you mentioned, we're talking about middle-of-the-field talent. Right. Catchers like Adley Rutschman, right? Shortstops like Carlos Correa, right? Center fielders and so on.
That's just not the case right now. Absolutely. But Weatherholt maybe has that opportunity to prove he can play shortstop.
Yeah, if he can prove that he can play shortstop, at least enough that scouting directors can convince himself they can send him out at shortstop, sure. Even if he moves to second, then maybe that's the case. But, like, there are, beyond that, I mean, to your point, like, there are first basemen. There's an intriguing two-way player.
I was about to say.
We'll get to that in a second. Yeah. But, like, there are some, like, center fielders that are possibilities. You know, they're just... They have some warts on them from the college side, right?
Like
Mike Sirota at Northeastern is a really, really good player. He just plays at Northeastern, right?
Yeah.
That's where Tom Glavin's brother is the coach, yeah. Mike. And so, good program.
Yeah, but the Colonial. It's the Colonial.
Right, the Colonial is not the...
We're not turning out, you know, top five picks.
Right, it's like the 8th or 9th or 10th, 12th conference. Vance Honeycutt at North Carolina is a tooled-up dude, but there's a lot of concerns about swing and miss.
And he had a... down year last year. I mean, he was incredible as a freshman. But.
Yeah, and it was like, I think it was a little bit better than he gets credit for because, I mean, he still got on base and he still hit for some power. But, like,
but we saw warts.
Yeah, there's warts. The warts that were there his freshman year didn't improve, really.
Yeah.
His junior year or his sophomore year. And, you know, and then I would put like Rodney Green Jr. at Cal in that mix, who is like maybe the most tooled up dude, but has the biggest concerns about swing and miss. And so those are some of the guys that are in the middle of the field. And then, like, in terms, and the thing is that those are the things that are pushing further down. And we haven't even talked about shortstops. Like, the best college shortstop for this draft right now, and really, I think he's a sleeper candidate to go 1-1, is Seaver King, who is at Wake Forest, who everybody you talk to who saw him play for Team USA last summer raves about him. Wake is a great hitting environment. He's going to push Merrick Houston off short, it seems like, and Houston was an excellent defender for Wake Forest. King is a transfer from a D2 school. And, like, we're talking about him as maybe being the best. And then behind him, it's, like, what, Caleb Bonnemer, who's the shortstop from Michigan, who's a really good player.
High school,
but he doesn't fit that kind of 1-1 mold.
If I'm picking first, I'm drafting Griff McGarry and getting him on steroids. That's what I'm doing.
Wait, why? I don't get the joke.
I think he means Griff O'Farrell.
Griff O'Farrell.
I was like, Griff McGarry.
Just,
why are we drafting
Griff
McGarry?
You know what is funny?
That was impressive that you figured that out.
At least he got the school
That's
right
true.
And the first name, but he screwed up the last name so badly that he picked
was
up
like,
a Phillies pitching prospect.
That's a good joke, though.
In exchange.
It would have been if you nailed it.
That's
the thing,
hey, let's try it again.
Oh,
Chris,
so much...
you can edit this,
no,
right?
No, absolutely not.
No, keep it in.
Absolutely
not.
I was just kidding about the editing.
You know what I would do? I would take Griff O'Farrell with the first pick and put him on steroids.
Hey-o!
Because he could play shortstop, but...
And he makes a lot of contact.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see. Okay, so Seaver King, though. First of all, you just mentioned, transfer from a Division II school.
Wingate.
That's a wild thing. Now, I understand he's put on some muscle, and he obviously developed in a big way. This is a kid in Athens, Georgia. It's a tough look for the Bulldogs.
Yeah, well, but he has one of the premier programs.
I understand.
Wake. So I mean, yeah, he was right in the background, in the backyard of.
But how do you miss him to begin with, right? Either way, but the point is that's a very interesting one. Now, if you're listening to this and you even have like a rudimentary knowledge of the draft in college baseball, you're wondering why are you not talking about Jack Caglione? Why are you not talking about Tommy White? I've heard of these guys. I want to talk about both of them.
Yeah,
Caglione first and foremost. I mean, if you're not familiar, he is a two-way player at the University of Florida. He was a very highly touted high school player in the state of Florida who was a left-handed pitcher who threw really hard, but ultimately he had Tommy John. He had big raw power, but not enough hit tool to really trust to take out of pro ball. Goes to Florida and has become one of the best two-way players we've ever seen at the college level. I mean,
he has the potential to be one of the best two-way players.
Yeah, but statistically, but he leads the country in home runs, and he's throwing 99, right? It's a little volatile. It's not a lot volatile, right? It's not like a Brendan McKay at Louisville. It was very polished on both sides of the ball. Whereas Caglione, it's like a shocking amount of power on both sides, and that has been a challenge for him on the mound in terms of throwing strikes. And at times... at the plate in terms of chasing and whatnot.
Yeah, so I think he's one of the more interesting players because he made some pretty significant mechanical changes in the fall in an effort to throw more strikes.
Yep.
And you're right, he throws 100 miles an hour. It's just that it's a little bit like if you've ever seen Bull Durham, he's Nuke LaLoosh, right? Like he might hit the bull mascot twice. What's the name of the Gator mascot?
Oh, does it have
Gary?
Know.
Gary?
No, it's not Gary.
Florida Gators.
He's
mascot.
Got a name.
Mater, Mater the Gator.
Albert. Yeah, Al Gator. Right.
Al Gator.
So he might hit Albert Alligator. Twice in the game, and so like that's what the but the delivery looked better this fall. And to your point, Jordan, it's a really good one. Like he has massive power. He led the nation in home runs last year.
He has like,
I mean,
it's
like
eight. It's at 80.
Yeah,
like,
it's
there's
raw.
No,
the scale
this
raw
is
power.
Not like, oh, he's going to be hit using metal bats.
It's like Chris Davis
stuff.
Power yes. from the left side, but he swings at everything. Like, he is off the bus to swing at the first pitch.
And it somehow worked.
If it's in the zone, it's out of the ballpark. Yeah. But otherwise, it's you know, there were a lot of strikeouts with him, and he doesn't walk very much.
Are you,
and
are
that's
you listening?
Something he needs to work.
Are you listening to this? Did you just drop your wallet? Oh, Jack Caglione swung at it.
Yeah. And so, and again, like, but this is not just like, wow, like he's got real juice, like he's got real, like, no. This is top of the as far as recent college players. You know, he's hitting balls even when you adjust four metal bats, maybe juiced baseballs, maybe juiced bats. He's hitting them 117, 118, 120 regularly, not one offs. Yeah. Like, oh, that's a TrackMan fluke. Like, he has ridiculous power. And so, my last question to you about Jack here is. You know, obviously, he's going to continue to pitch at the college level. But I'm curious, again, if he hits another 30 home runs, do you see, is the physical talent going to be too much to pass up for a team? And now, again, now that we have the draft order, we can look at the top and kind of start to speculate which organizations would be more likely to try this.
So that's what I was going to say, and this is related to a question I have. I cannot envision a world where Cleveland takes him 1-1.
No, not right now.
Not right now. If he makes the necessary improvements in the spring, then maybe.
Yeah.
He just seems, they love guys who make a lot of contact in the zone, right?
I mean, I don't know. I don't even know. Like, the Angels are right there, guys.
Oh.
I know. I don't think he's, right? I'll tell you what. I don't think he's a Tim McIlvain kind of pick. I really don't. I know that they've had guys, you know, they get a lot of flack for how quickly guys have moved, and I think some of that has to do with the way that their owner has kind of demanded things.
Well,
go.
I'm talking about the two-way thing, not the
I don't think it's going to be.
And it's not even just Ohtani. I mean, they've had other guys in the minors. Like, there are only so many teams that they have tried it.
Giants have done it a lot.
So,
yeah,
now
Crawford
again,
comes to mind.
And I'm curious if what kind of season he has to have to ensure that he goes out as a two-way player. Because at this point, I just think that the offensive potential is so overwhelming that I just have to imagine, and I actually don't know what he wants to do. Sometimes players feel very strongly about doing one way or the other or doing both. I'm not sure where he's at right now, and that could change as things happen.
I think most organizations would send him out both ways to see, to let him know. They may have a preference or feeling, but they, okay, if you want to do both, let's see until you fail at it. I mean, we mentioned Reggie Crawford before with the Giants. Giants really liked him on the mound because of his arm, but he wanted to be a two-way player. And so, like, he was hitting in the Arizona Fall League, and he struggled. He hasn't hit much as a pro, in part because he had Tommy John surgery before his junior year, and so he's been, kind of working his way back on the mound, but they shut him down so he could do that. And so, like, there's guys that'll do it. In fact, they did it last. Who was the kid from Virginia? Was it?
Bryce Eldridge.
Bryce Eldridge, right? Yeah, the high school kid who's a two-way guy. So, like, they'll give him an opportunity to do it. But I think your bigger point is okay, so, like, what are the things we need to know? And it goes back to controlling the strike zone. And as we get deeper into draft stuff, which I think we will a lot here, we'll talk more about the way teams are using statistical models to help build out draft profiles. And a lot of it has to do with when they're swinging at pitches, are they swinging at pitches in the strike zone? And how often are they landing pitches in the zone and getting hitters to miss, right? So, like, it's how do you control the strike, which makes intuitive sense, right? Like, how do you control the strike zone as a pitcher or as a hitter is going to be the number one priority. And we won't know until we see Caglione this spring how much he's really improved. Is what was happened in the fall a precursor, or is he, in the words of Dave Esker at Stanford, who dropped this one on me, is he a fall American?
We love fall Americans.
Oh, well, I love fall Americans.
As a former fall American, there's three levels. There's a fall American, a fall star, and a fall of famer.
Yeah.
Were you a fall of famer?
I was. Yeah. Let me ask you a question about Cleveland specifically. Cleveland has developed a pretty clear MO with their draft strategy over the last five or so years. They're easily one of the top model-driven teams in the league. which means they tend to draft guys who are younger for the class, right? Do you anticipate now that they have the first overall pick that they will be as beholden to that model as they've been when they've drafted like 23rd or 18th?
So I haven't had a chance to talk to anybody from Cleveland yet. I'm assuming I will later today at some point, just kind of about what their thoughts are. But I think what it has tended to be has been, if you're looking at prep players, that has been the bigger driving force, specifically prep hitters. That's where there seemed to be some advantage built in. And since there isn't that prep middle infielder that you go that fits the Francisco Lindor, even I know it hasn't worked out great, but Carson Tucker, who was a first rounder a few years ago, Cole Tucker's younger brother, like those guys in that mix, I don't know. Unless, and again, like I'll put this giant asterisk on it, they would be a team that, because there isn't a clear-cut number one, you know, as it stands right now, they're a team that would build a talent portfolio, which means that instead of just taking the player that you have number one on your board, you take the best player with a similar grade to the guy you have number one that saves you the most money on that pick so that you can reallocate that to push better talent down to you later in the draft.
Yeah.
And that's a really complex part of baseball drafting, but it's an important one. And I think Cleveland has, because they have so much more pool money now and because they'll have competitive balance picks, that's something that I would keep an eye on with this, is that they aren't necessarily going to take the top player in the draft, number one, or the consensus top player, if in fact it doesn't shake out like this.
Right. They could very realistically do what Pittsburgh, we've seen Pittsburgh do that in a very real way when they've been picking at the very top.
If there's a clear cut number one,
sure,
you take him.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. Now, I think the last couple kind of groups that I think we should definitely mention, we talked about Caglione, two-way player, whatever. Let's talk about the pitching, because if you're wondering, okay, who are the top arms? And I think that there's a lot of depth, but the ones at the top right now have some also pretty massive question marks, I would say. So I would say that the first name to throw out there is Chase Burns, who is a right-handed pitcher who is very highly regarded as a high schooler in Tennessee, goes to the University of Tennessee, has a lot of success as a freshman. As a sophomore, it's a little bit more bumpy. He loses his rotation spot. He moves to the bullpen and is sensational. But now he transfers to Wake Forest, where he is very much expected to be in the rotation. Wake Forest is a great, of course, reputation development, particularly pitching development. And to see how Chase Burns, who again throws, you know, he'll be upper 90s with the ridiculous slider, see the tweaks that he can make. A pure arm talent, it's right there, but and Wake Forest is the perfect place for him to figure it out.
Right.
And that marriage there is, like, I wonder if we'd be talking about Chase Burns as the first pitcher, and maybe you disagree with me as talking about Chase Burns as the first pitcher, so you can answer that, but if he was still at Tennessee, he would be in the conversation, certainly as a first-round talent. But I think that we are such believers in the Wake Forest operation and that move, that it's going to put him in a really good position to succeed.
I mean,
but maybe that's overrated. I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think he probably would still be considered that based on the stuff that he had. Remember, when he, like, the reason why Chase Burns transferred, Tennessee knew that he was going to, is because he was struggling and he moved into a closer's role. The team was struggling a little bit. He was struggling. They moved him into the bullpen. He shoved out of the pen. He looked like the Chase Burns that pitched as a freshman, who was one of the top pitchers in the country. And so I think that talent is still there. So I think based on the quality of his stuff, he is probably going to be considered at the top of the draft anyway, whether or not he had transferred to Wake. Wake has had a way of making the pitchers that they have better, much, much better. And so that, I think, is part of the discussion with him. But as much as we talked about this draft class being different than last year's and maybe not quite as good, it's actually pretty deep on the mound. And you're right, these guys are flawed. But if it's not, you know, Burns, like, there's a bunch of intriguing guys.
I also love, though, that we just talk about Burns, like, wow, okay, he's got real crazy stuff, but, you know, he's got some things to iron out. Brody Brecht somehow has crazier stuff than Chase Burns, which seems impossible.
And he might not even be the best pitcher on his roster.
Right. So,
Iowa.
Right. And they've got a staff now with Marcus Morgan and Cade Obermueller, like that's a Iowa's going to be they're going to that's three guys right there that could all go, you know, in the first few rounds. But Brody Brecht, who was a football player at Iowa and finally, you know, this past year decided to step away from football, which the little I know about college football sounds like a good decision to step away from Iowa football. But his, I mean, we saw him earlier this year pitch in an early season tournament for Iowa where he walked eight guys. And I was still impressed. I was like, oh, my God. That guy
it was the best eight-walk performance I've ever seen.
It was against LSU, who was the number one team in the nation at the time.
And they won that
one
game.
Hit.
And they won the game.
And they had one hit. They had no chance.
I mean, he was absolutely dominant. And his fastball is going to get a lot of attention, but his slider is his best pitch. And so, you know, between – so like we mentioned Burns. You know, Josh Hartle, who's also at Wake Forest, is going to be a first-round guy. Lefty, who's a little bit more traditional. It's a fastball cutter. He's been a pretty good prospect for a long time, you know, going back to his high school days. He's going to be a guy that's in the mix. Michael Massey is a guy to really watch who's going to move into the rotation this year, who was an elite reliever for Wake Forest last year. He's another name that's in that. Hagen Smith is a guy that I love at Arkansas. He's a left-hander who's up to 98, who has wipeout stuff. Matt, you know, as much as we talk about Wake Forest now, their former pitching coach is Matt Hobbs, who's at Arkansas, and he has Hagen Smith and Brady Tigert, who started at the end of last year, who I think Brady Tigert's fastball-slider combination might be the best of any of the right-handers in the draft. He's not as overpowering as Burns.
That's a flaming take.
But it's got a really good fastball and good command of it. And the slider is wipeout. It's more of a traditional, what they would call a gyro slider, right? So, like, the sweepers are the ones that move a lot east to west. His is one that's got a little bit more tilt to it. I really like Tigert a lot. And then you get into, like, Thatcher Hurd, who, if you watch the College World Series this year, pitched very well for LSU. I got a couple of people in the last 2 weeks who told me that Gage Jump, who transferred from UCLA this year, was unbelievable this fall. The only reason why he wouldn't be ranked higher is that he's had injuries the last 2 years that have limited his availability at UCLA. So, like, we're talking all about this. And you mentioned all the guys at Iowa, like, that's a number of college pitchers that we see that could be in that.
They can work them way into an even higher tier,
right?
Which is exciting.
And,
I agree.
And because they have a ton of stuff.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to hit the high school class, which is not especially looking especially great right now, but it is a very important part of this process. We'll be right back on Prospect Barbacast. And welcome back to Prospect Barbacast. Jordan Schusterman here with Mike Farron, Jake Mintz, and I know I just teased we're going to talk about the high schoolers, but we have to talk about Tommy White first because I know that he has a lot of name recognition. Tommy Tanks, freshman sensation at NC State, transfers to LSU, and while the home runs were not as plentiful, he was an even better overall hitter. And watching him work, he is not necessarily the straight, burly slugger just going up there to try and hit it. Like, this dude knows what the hell he's doing in the box. But I'm fascinated with what you think about him as a draft prospect. But Jake, I know you, I mean, Tommy, like, he is, and I've thought this, I remember, I was so excited, like, you know, he was known in high school and Florida at IMG Academy and probably could have gotten $1.5 million, but ends up going to NC State. And I remember even at the time being like, wow, like he could be a star in college, but it's going to be a fascinating draft discussion because he's been playing third base and he's not awful there. And I know we made this joke on our last show, right? How it's like you make excuses for bad defenders when they absolutely rake. And that is exactly the case for Tommy Tanks.
But the bar for his offense will determine where he has to play. Like, there is a version of Tommy Tanks where the defense in a minor league system gets incrementally better because he gets in better shape and he gets more athletic. I'm just saying that's one bucket. The other is that he rakes enough to be a first baseman. And then the other bucket is neither of these things happen and it's a bad pick, right?
Yeah.
The thing that I love about Tommy Tanks, and this is talking to people who had to game plan against him in the World Series last year, that he's a dog in the box.
Yeah.
People
loves
are
to compete.
Horrified of pitching to this guy. Yeah. Now, are the tools, like, is the not the power is different, right? But are the tools going to play at the big league level in the box? That's the question. If he was an elite athlete and an up the middle defender, he's in the conversation for the top five pick, right? But it's the combo of the uncertainty of the approach plus the lack of athleticism.
Yeah. But I want to bring Nick Kurtz back into this conversation because the next question I was, because we didn't touch on him at all. And the reason is from Tommy White perspective, what is the highest you could conceive of him going?
Tommy White?
Yeah, because I
number one, if he shows up and he's freaking yoked in the spring.
I mean, no, it's like that isn't dude. No, it's the opposite. I need him to be playing a mean third base and like essentially.
That's what I meant. He shows up and he's just like in sick shape.
Yeah.
And like he's twitchy and he's playing a good third. But
Nick, and I know he's a right-handed hitter. Nick Kurtz, left-handed hitter, and that's a factor too. And there's the. But I'm curious. He didn't walk as much as you maybe would have hoped for him last year, but.
He didn't strike out a ton.
He didn't strike out a ton either, that's true. But I assume this year he's going to walk more in a slightly worse LSU lineup at the very least. But I'm curious where you think his ceiling is, because that's someone with numbers-wise is not really... I mean, he's right there with Nick Kurtz, right? Yeah. He really is, and he's still playing third base, and how he still seems to be a tier below, whereas Nick Kurtz is like clearly number one.
So the difference is the athleticism, right? So let's start with the difference between the two. Kurtz is a left-handed hitter with massive power who the only reason he's not playing the outfield at Wake is that he's actually an excellent defender at first. I mean, they tried him in the outfield, and he had an injury there.
Got it.
In first fall, I think he had diving play and separated his shoulder, and so they stuck him back at first base, and he's just like there's to your point. It's those things like there's twitch to him, right?
Yeah.
Like there's athleticism and there's snap to his swing and there's like legit light tower power, and he hits left-handed on top of it, right? So like that's the big reason why is he's always got largely has the platoon advantage, right? He's going to face more right-handed pitching.
Yes.
That's going to be a key.
And more walks and strikeouts.
Yeah. Kurtz moves like an NBA wing player, and Tommy White kind of moves like your buddy.
A backup center.
Like your buddy.
I mean, I think so. Like White, I think it's unfair to say that he is not a good athlete. I think he is not as athletic as you want. And so, like, here's the concern is, and I'll use a recent LSU guy, and it's not a perfect analog because this guy was a switch hitter. But you know, Jacob Berry was a guy that was the number six overall pick in the draft 2 years ago by the Marlins. He had been the top freshman in the country at Arizona. He transferred to LSU for his sophomore year. He's a draft eligible sophomore. Jay Johnson, who was the head coach at LSU, who had been at Arizona, got him to go there. They got him to work at third base to make him passable there. But he's just not this, like, twitchy athlete. He's just a little bit kind of stiffer, and it has to be a really good approach in order for him to take advantage of pitches in the zone to hit. And Berry is a little bit more aggressive in that regard, right? And he hasn't played all that well in pro ball. White is a really good hitter to your point, Jordan, in that he can use the middle of the field well. He's kind of got that old school RBI man feel,
you can roll your eyes at RBIs. Mm-hmm. 105 in 66 games.
I mean,
even with like knowing Dylan Cruz hitting ahead of you and all these things, it's just like that's not an accident.
No, it's nuts, and it's very Pete Alonso-esque in that regard. And when Alonso was at Florida, and similar to MJ Melendez, or not MJ Melendez, Ivan Melendez, the Hispanic Titanic, who the Diamondbacks took in the second round 2 years ago, who had been the Golden Spikes Award winner at Texas. Now, Melendez had probably a little bit more swing and miss in his game than White does, but White's a good hitter with a questionable defensive profile that he has to be able to get to his power in order to have success. And the question is he athletic enough to be able to get to that? That's a big question that scouts are going to be looking for this spring. If he is, he's probably like a mid-to-back first-round guy. I could see him like the worst-case scenario is he's a guy like Seth Beer, right, that gets a cup of coffee and who just doesn't have the right kind of athleticism to be able to tap into his skills. But like Tommy White's going to be a first baseman in pro ball. The Diamondbacks keep playing Ivan Melendez in third, and you talk to people like, "Yeah, it's getting better.
Yeah, it's getting better."
And it's like,
no,
like
fine.
Just don't lie to me. His job
don't
is
lie to
me.
I would say
it probably has improved, but it's still not great.
Charlie Condon of Georgia also factors into this conversation.
Very
as,
similar.
As a first base type. But I want to move to the high schoolers before we get out of here because that, I think, in the this is the fifth year that I've followed the draft like intensely closely. And I can't remember, again, this is a small sample, so you can have a better sense for this.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the industry boards right now and you talk to people, like, you don't get to a high schooler before 15, 20, 25. Mm-hmm. And there's almost no way that there won't be a high schooler that's picked in the top 10. But as it stands now, this is where the class is very, very, very weak. But we should talk about a couple. You just mentioned Caleb Bonnemer earlier, high school shortstop in Michigan. But it, does this feel, from that perspective, like especially, I can't, I'm not going to say historic, but at this point in the cycle, after a whole summer where you normally you have guys kind of show up on a showcase circuit and make a name for themselves and clearly start to stand out, that just didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
I think Connor Griffin was the one guy who
kind of... Yeah, he sits right now at the top.
Right.
But he, it's not like he's in the conversation in the top five at the top of the top overall, I would say,
I
right
think
now.
He's a guy
he
that can
there.
Do that.
He could get
just
there.
In conversation. Like, listen, the publicly available draft lists don't have him that high.
Yep.
In talking with scouts and seeing him at Perfect Game All-American, like, Griffin...
He looks the part.
Yeah, he definitely
sure
does.
Looks the part.
He's an outfielder. He's from Mississippi. He reclassified. He was originally a 25. He reclassified to the 24 draft. He's a right-handed hitter. He's pretty athletic. He's got real power.
He does pitch, too. And some people are like, oh,
I don't think it's going to be
him.
He's going to hit.
Yep.
And so I think he's probably the guy that's in the mix. But then the other guys behind it, you mentioned Bonnemer. He's a really intriguing player. I'm not sure that he stays at shortstop, but I think he can hit enough. He might end up being a second baseman. And then it's like, you know, P.J. Morlando, who is
great name,
outfield first base type. I mean,
And he's older. That's another thing. If you look at a lot of the high school players at the top of this class, you mentioned Connor Griffin. He's younger because he reclassified. A lot of these top hitters at the very top of this class, like the one you just mentioned, who I'm just – oh, Morlando. Morlando, you know, 19 on draft day. That's a concept we're definitely going to be hitting on. Derek Curiel, an outfielder from Southern California who was kind of at the top of this class at points over the last year. He's another one, you know, 19 on draft day. Bryce Rainier. Rainer. Do you know the pronunciation on that? Rainier? Another Harvard-Westlake kid. Shortstop, that's another one who's a little bit older. And so that's another thing where, again, Jake referenced to, you know, model-friendly teams. Some teams don't necessarily are as in on older high schoolers. There are some successful stories of that, so I don't want to make too much of that. But at the very least, like, one's jumping off the page
right
now.
Okay, so let me give a couple things. Like, I had a scouting director this summer. We were talking about Morlando. We were watching him. He was like, when was the last time there was like a really successful big leaguer that was a first-round high school draft pick out of South Carolina? And
it's funny you say that because I've heard the same thing about Mississippi.
So this, that's fine. But there's a little different athleticism with Griffin than there is with Morlando.
Oh, of course.
You have to go back
course.
To like Preston Wilson in 1992. You know, to find a guy who had like a 6-WAR career, you know, or better.
So is
like
that
it's been a while?
Interesting.
So it's you know, not necessarily known as the prep, at least for prep players out of the draft. There are some great players in South Carolina that went to college and then became good pros.
Bauman reminds us every day.
Yeah, I mean, like I think you think of Justin Smoke, right? Like there's a guy who was, I believe he was in South Carolina. Like it wasn't he? And Matt Wieters was from South Carolina too, I think, right? Weren't they both South Carolina kids? I think they may have gone to the same high school. That doesn't happen very often. So that I think is interesting with Morlando. I think let me give you a couple other names that I think are guys that are intriguing that have some upside and have some ability. Aiden Harris is a third baseman from suburban DC who hits the ball incredibly hard. He's a right-handed hitter, but really athletic with power. And there's a lot to like about Aiden Harris. Again, we're probably looking down further in the first round or maybe into the second. The other guy who I think can move up because catching is always such a premium is actually Cade Arambidi is a guy that I think is intriguing because he has one of the strongest catching arms that we've seen from a prep player over the last at least decade. I mean, I think, I don't know that his arm strength was quite the same, but like Will Banfield, who's a catcher in the Marlins system, was
Rule 5
really,
eligible.
Yeah, Rule 5 eligible. I actually put together a good season offensively, finally.
Yeah.
But he was always a guy that had really good, was a really good defender and had a strong arm. Aaron Beattie can hit a little bit too. And so, like, that's a guy that I think could move up because, like, prep catching is a really, really dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Dangerous profile, right? But he's a guy that I think would be of interest and is worth keeping an eye on this spring.
The last name I want to mention, and then we can wrap here and return to all the news that's happening here at the winter meetings, is Slade Caldwell. This is someone that I've had some conversations with. He's an outfielder from Alabama, I believe. And Arkansas. Ole Miss commit. And it's simple. He's really, really small. Very, 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 very small player. And
he's a lot of fun, though.
All of the discussions about him now, he's a left-handed hitter, and he's an outfielder, but I'm just hearing Jet Williams.
Adam Eaton, kind of player.
But I as a comp, that's true. Obviously, Jet Williams is a shortstop. But I mean from the perspective of when Jet Williams, who is now a Mets prospect and has had success in pro ball, that year, especially going into it, and then as that spring went on, everyone would say, like, man, if he was 3 inches taller, he'd be going in the top 10. And I've already heard that multiple times about Slade Caldwell, and I don't know how high he can climb, but that's a player that I'm very excited to see how much what he can do. Because he again, in terms of people who had really good summers, he fits.
I think he's a really interesting one. I'll give you another one as a right-handed hitter who's a little bit undersized. Ty Salvacine,
who is from Las Vegas. That's such a fun
who
one.
Is a middle infielder who is maybe the swaggiest player in the class, too. So, like, there's some real tools there. And Ty Salvacine is, Ty Salvacine makes confident people look shy. Like, he just
this kid is awesome.
You would love him, Jake. He has
four or five brothers that are all like that are young that also play
and a twin
baseball.
That plays baseball
and
right
plays baseball.
Yeah.
And I believe his parents I'm gonna botch that. I'm pretty sure his parents are from Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
Laos. Yeah.
Laos and moved to Vegas and had all these kids and now just have this like they have, I think, four kids that all play baseball and are all prospects. But Ty is so much fun. Wow. Also undersized. An incredible story. Like I believe PG did a good feature with him.
I think Danny Wex.
I'm sure she'll be on this show at some point. But if you watch him play, watch him swing.
I love
another
Ty
one. That's a really, really fun one. In terms of, again, though, but like smaller and it's an interesting profile.
He's going to be a fun player to watch. But again, all these guys that we're talking about, they're fun. But none of them have, like, top-of-the-draft pedigree of what we saw out of the prep guys last year.
I totally agree.
And it feels like Clark and Jenkins.
It feels like Connor Griffin has, like, a 15% chance to just go absolutely ham in the spring and play his way into a clear top-10 pick. But other than that, as it stands now, it's going to be a lot more of a pop-up situation. All right, we're going to end it here. This has been Prospect Barbacast. Jake is getting sleepy. It's a little too early to be talking about the 2024 draft.
It's December 5th. We're at the winter meetings, guys.
Dude.
Never too early.
Like, is it too early to be talking about prospects, too?
I will say,
December.
No, I'm not saying
the season doesn't.
I will say, though.
Too, 1 second.
You've got to let us geek out about this stuff. Oh. This is why we're doing this.
No, I understand that. What I'm saying is, for me, I don't have enough brain space to hold all this information up to now. And so this is useful for me, and I hope that it is useful. And again, I'm not, like, I love this shit. I just have other pursuits.
I will say, this is how I feel about talking about the next draft before the draft happens. So, like, before, like, especially now that the draft is later, talking about 2025 when it's June or May drives me insane. That like pisses me off.
That
but we'll deal with
most,
that when we get there.
That is the most niche pet peeve of all time. Could you imagine, like, you meet Jordan at a party and what's your pet peeve? Oh, I hate it when, people put the seat back in the airplane. And Jordan's like, you know what I hate?
This is worse than CPAC on the airplane. Are you kidding me?
I am slightly with you. Like, I don't mind the TLDR. I'm like the next year's draft. It's like 25. It's not going to be great from the prep standpoint. And 26 is going to be really
good.
That's
fine. But if
you're, we're 2 years, from it. We have I don't need to go any deeper than that right now. Like, we have so many players we're going to get to cover. And listen, the great thing, too, I want to point out about this is, especially with the college players, and this should be a fairly college-heavy draft at the top, most of those players are on TV.
Bingo.
Frequently.
Bingo.
Yeah. And just a quick reminder that college baseball games start counting like on Valentine's Day. So if you love baseball and you hate watching exhibition baseball because it's boring
and
as
nobody
hell,
cares.
Which
yes.
I get from spring training can be if there's not like a super great prospect or somebody who's new to your team.
Or
college baseball is a great route to go. Friday, Saturday, Sundays are games that matter. The midweeks can be really fun early in the season because they're usually rivalry games. Like, that's a great way to get to learn about these guys while also seeing some baseball that matters. And that's the thing I love about the – like, as much as I think the season starting on February 15th is just bonkers, like, the fact that we get to see games that count is awesome.
I totally agree. Well said. But February is still sort of a long way away. But Prospect Barbacast will roll on. Thank you, Mike Farron. Thank you, Jake Mintz. Thank you, producer Chris Tyler. Hopefully you enjoyed this latest edition of Prospect Barbacast. You can send your emails. We will funnel them to Mike if they need to be. BaseballBarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. No new email address for this show. Hopefully you've been enjoying it so far. We'll be back on Friday without Mike. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Goodbye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.